home of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And I'm Rob. Garrett is off tonight. He is doing his thing out being Mr. Blonde Jesus. But tonight I have a fantastic show, and I believe my guest is on the line. We're going to test that out in just a minute. But I have April Allen, who is a renowned author, playwright, composer, musician. She has two award-winning albums, and today she is releasing her book, which she has worked on for 2 years, called A Tango with Cancer. And we are going to find out all about that. And April.
Hi, Rob.
Ah, it worked. Amazing.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Oh, I am too. It's like, you know, I mean, first of all, I've been looking forward to talking to you. We've been exchanging kind of communications, but then I was out in Twitter world and realized that you were actually releasing the book today.
And I was like, it's been crazy.
It's so exciting. This is an amazing, I feel weird calling it a book because it's more than that. I mean, it's like
it
this
is.
Piece of your soul. I mean, that is what you take away when you read it and you absorb it. And, but let's dial it back for everybody who hasn't caught up to you and I yet.
Sure.
And what's going on here. Give us a little background on, you're a musician. You've got this whole amazing expression going on and, speaking for a culture that, you want to be the legacy, adherent for. Tell us a little bit about the background.
Sure. So I ended up, my first album is called Morning Star, and in Comanche you pronounce that Da-Datsunup, and that's my Comanche name that was given to me by an elder in my family. And so I wrote this album because I had the opportunity to work with some amazing musicians, Richie Cannata, who's Billy Joel's original saxophonist, and he has a studio on Long Island called Cove City Sound Studios, and everyone has recorded there, from the Beach Boys, Jennifer Lopez, Mark Anthony, Celine Dion. Everybody has recorded in his studio. And he ended up hearing a piece that I had written, and I ended up, to make a long story short, co-writing with him, Julio Fernandez from Spyro Gyra, Richie's son Aaron. Then it was just really amazing what had happened. And the album, at the time when I was writing it, I found out that they had a Native American Grammy that you could submit for. So I thought, what the heck? Why not give that a try? So I wrote the song Shapeshifter for that, and come to find out you had to submit an entire album with that genre of music. So we went back to the chalkboard, but prior to doing that, I had submitted that first album to the Grammys, which qualified for 5 Grammys, which I thought was really cool. And because of that album, they ended up making me a voting Grammy member, which was just, you can imagine how I felt after that happened. Yeah. So, and one of my favorite songs, well, all of them are, but one of my favorite songs on that album is called Velvet Voice, and Julio and I co-wrote that together, and that won for the best jazz song on ourstage.com back in 2009, and it's received many accolades. So then let's fast forward, and I ended up writing this album called Shapeshifter, Na'una Na'ai, and it was how it started. I sat down with my aunt in Oklahoma, and she started telling me all these stories about our family history. And one of them is about Duamua, who his name translates to Black Moon. He was my great-great-grandfather. And he was killed at the hands of a white man, two white men, who broke into his house in the middle of the night because he was a prosperous Native American man who was making it in the world. And they were upset, and they wanted him to pay him money. I don't know the whole thing, but I do have the paperwork on my website from that depicts his death. So from that, when I hear stories like that, it draws me in, and I end up writing about them. And then, unfortunately, I play the flute and a little bit of the piano. Both I play them, both the Native American flute and the regular flute, the silver flute. But it was so I needed help in writing the music, and these guys stepped up to the plate. It was fun during the studio session because we'd be working on it, and they would go a little Japanese or Chinese on me, and I'd have to pull them back and say, okay, this is Native American. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, and the album is just stunning. We tapped
into
some.
Oh, it's amazing. No, it's wonderful.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun to work on, and all the musicians that worked on that with me were just really amazing. And one of the songs that I wrote was for my mother, who passed away from breast cancer in 2002, and that's titled Morning Star. And on the page next to it in my lyric booklet, and it's also on my my website, it talks about Jane Muthami, who is my grandmother, and she passed away at the age of 24 with her seven children gathered around her bed because her appendix ruptured. So they sent a family friend on a horse to get the doctor, and this was back in 1930. And the doctor sent a message back and said, I will not work. I will not come and help this woman. And I don't care if the whole damn family dies. Yeah. And this was in 1930. So
with that kind of legacy, and I mean, I'd love to say, you know, gee, isn't it great that now, you know, 76 years later that things are so different. But you look at this current election, and there's a lot that isn't.
I am so sad about what is happening. I feel like we worked so hard at trying to teach children about bullying and eradicating it from our schools and being colorblind to the color of people's skins, not being afraid of languages or who people decide they're going to love. I feel like I'm going to start crying because this cannot be our world. What is wrong with us? Something needs to be fixed. There's just so much anger anymore, and I don't know what to do. And I hope we figure out a way to fix this because it's heartbreaking. Everyone,
right.
This is everyone's planet. What are we doing?
Well, you know, it's ironic because you know the subject we're going to talk about in a minute is almost analogous to this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like in many ways, this is the cancer in our society. And you, in your book, you call your cancer Jorge. And
I do. I was told by a medicine man to name my cancer, and I was to talk to him throughout the period. And then before the surgery, I was to tell him to leave my body and never return. And
right.
There was a really cool thing that happened to me when I did this. And we can get into that later if you'd like.
Yeah, well, maybe we should name this bias and inequality and hatred something. Although right now that something is, it does have a name. It's Donald Trump. And, you know, ironically.
Agreed. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and you know, kick him to the curb, you know, as symbolism of the same way that you rid your body of Jorge. Let's fast forward because before we get into the detail of the book and your story itself, I was fascinated by the melding of music and songs and dance and all of that connection within the story. You tell the story within that framework.
Mm-hmm.
What is music a spiritual framework for you, or what was the inspiration to put it together that way?
Sure. Well, first of all, when you think about it from a Native American standpoint, that's often how we told our stories. We handed them down through song, through music, and dancing in our powwows. Everything is symbolic. So when I think about my music and how I created it, it was, you're going to think I'm kind of silly, but I actually call upon my ancestors to help me tell their story. Whatever piece of music I'm writing, that's how I work. And I'll give you, okay, now I'm going to go back to the Morningstar album and Velvet Voice. When I was getting ready to work with Julio Fernandez, he says to me, April, I write more than, I can do other types of genre. I'm not just about jazz. And I said, okay, I get that, but Julio, that's not how I work. Whatever comes out of me is what comes out of me. He said, okay. So I go home, and I'm working on the piece, and it just came to me immediately. Words and melodies, lyrics and melodies come to me at the same time. And it's almost as if I'm seeing a story, and I'm experiencing it myself. So I write the song, and I think, oh, no, this is not pop at all, because that's what Julio wanted to do, was write a pop song. And I thought, okay, this is more bossa nova, if anything. So I call Richie, and I said, I don't know if Julio's going to like this. And he said, well, sing it to me on the phone. So I sang it to him, and he goes, where are you? He said, call me back in 10 minutes. I said, okay. And I call back, and Julio was recording there at his studio. And he goes, sing the song for him, April. And I did. And he says, April, this is kismet. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I was just sitting in Richie's office here not more than an hour ago, and asked him if he thought you could write something like a bossa nova tune.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's like crazy. And he also said he worked on both of my albums. Both he and Richie did, of course. Richie produced my albums. And he said, Julio pulled me aside, and he said, you know, April, this is magic what you're doing. He said, we go in the studio and can work months at a time on an album, and that's how long it takes. We've done these albums, each of them, in a week.
Wow. Well, yeah. Now I have to tell you, I completely relate to the process you just talked about, because I don't go to my ancestors, but when I write, I go to kind of my spiritual entity, and at 4 a.m, I will wake up and an article is writing in my head. And I try to do is remember what is coming through me at that point, you know. And so I'm just trying to, because I'm half asleep, and you know, my bigger fear is that I'm gonna wake up 2 hours later and go, okay, something was there. And I'm working my memory to capture it, and then when I get up, then I start writing it. Now it's in a very raw form, but, and I have to work it, but that I get that channel of letting it come through. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
And you have
amazing
to be open to it. Yeah. And when it happens, you have to be ready as well.
It is actually what makes it incredibly rewarding. I mean, rather than sitting down and doing this stuff, like you're figuring out a puzzle and it's all, you know, sort of on that superficial level, when it comes out that way, it's like just captivating. And I totally, totally get that. But so let's go to, you know, so you were bopping along musically, in tune with the ancestors, literally, and everything was going right. And then what happened?
Okay, so after I won the Shapeshifter album, after I wrote it, I won a Native American Music Award. I was nominated for 4 NAMMYs, and I qualified for 7 Grammys. And the cover was even one of them. It was submitted for best cover of the year, and it made it into that category. But Johnny Depp won that year. I guess I don't have the vehicle that he has to promote it. So, But it was cool to see my name on the same page.
Yeah, if you had made Edward Scissorhands the years before, you would have been in there.
Yeah, exactly. So I had just come off this high of writing this album. I sang with the Phoenix Symphony, and then the Arizona Opera approached me after my performance and asked if I knew anyone that could write a Native American musical. And I said, I do, me. So I thought, why not? So I'm in the process of writing this and doing all the research for it and just madly in love with my life. Everything is just humming along. Yes, we're coming out of the recession, but I'm just so thrilled. I'm living my dream. And then I go in for my annual mammogram, and they did not catch the cancerous nodule on the 3D mammogram. What we caught was a lymph node that looked a little angry, as my radiologist called it. So that was kind of disappointing to me, because I wonder how long that cancer was there and we were just unable to see it. And women, often we're all in there. We go into this fun machine and we see the signs that say, ask if you have dense breast tissue, and you always do. And dense breast tissue shows up white on a mammogram. And guess what color cancer shows up as? White.
Probably white.
Yep. So yeah, they can't see it. So what is all our alternative? I mean, you know, you ask the question and nothing more is really done about it.
Right.
So I go ahead and I go in and I go through all the protocol. It ends up coming up cancerous. And, wow, what I was not expecting, the alternate world I was about to walk into. That's one thing.
I can imagine. I want to interject some information here before we go on the story, because I think it's really pertinent to what people need to take away. I mean, the early prevention and that kind of that ignorance and missing it is part of a lot of people's story. It reminds me of what Gene Wilder talked, came out when he passed away, about Gilda Radner, and she had carried around cancer in herself for a long, long time before they actually diagnosed it. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's like this process is not right. But some of the facts, you know, 1 in 3 women will develop cancer of some kind throughout their lifetime. In 2006 alone, 2.5 million people will receive a cancer diagnosis. So your story is more than just a story. You are sharing information and a path that a lot of people can learn from.
Right. It's right. Terrifying, isn't it? And when I did my research, when I was doing my book, when was this? Back in 2014, 2015, I saw the statistic that 1 in 3 people in the United States, during my research, I found this, was going to have cancer at some point in their life. But then just recently doing an interview, and then you just reiterated it, it's changed to 1 in 3 women will have cancer. 1 in 2 men will have cancer.
Right.
That's
and
terrifying.
And I have a feeling that men are, because I am executive editor of a publication called The Goodman Project. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons that I'm so involved in that is men have a habit of not asking for help. And, you know, for mental health, physical health, out of every 4 suicides, 3 are men. So it's like, it's, you know, and I have to imagine that the cancer statistics are similar, that men are less likely to show up and have it diagnosed early.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the facts on that. That's just my.
Right, right.
Why
I think
should
you
we
may
be
right
about that? You know,
right.
In your storytelling of what happened, you wrap it in this kind of, and I'm going to call it spiritual, because to me that's a lot about what music is and dance and that kind of expression. But you found the process anything but spiritual, correct?
That's right. That is right. At least dealing with our healthcare system on a different level when I was on my own, I didn't realize it. The few people that have read the book have come back to me and said, I didn't realize you were such a spiritual individual. And when I look back at some of the processes I did on my own, wow, I guess I am. So, but no, the way I was treated within healthcare, I remember my mom when she, before she passed away, she got up off the table when they told her cancer had come back. She was in remission for 2 years. And she got up off the table and they said, okay, we need to start chemo and radiation treatments and all the stuff all over again. And she gets up and she says, no, no more. I didn't understand it at the time. And I think a lot of people felt she just gave up, but she didn't give up. What she gave up on was the system. And that is so sad. And I can't tell you how many women I have met that are living with cancer and will not, breast cancer, another one had brain cancer, they will not go back to the healthcare system because of how they're treated. Mm. What does that say to us? I mean,
there's so much complexity that one is, you know, exactly what you experienced with the healthcare system. And I want to get into that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But on
mm-hmm.
another level, even if the healthcare system was better and, you know, the cancer, you know, for some people where the cancer is winning is to give people power over their own destinies.
Mm-hmm.
On my other radio show, which you, and I'll segue into that a little bit, you are scheduled to be a guest on that one as well, out in Santa
mm-hmm.
Cruz on
mm-hmm.
Saturday night.
Yes.
We had a wonderful woman on. And it was right when the California State Legislature was in the process of passing a bill that allowed terminal patients to end their life easier. And I'm not
mm-hmm.
quite even sure exactly where that is right now. But she was on advocating for this bill, and her point about that action was that people in that situation do not want to die. They are not suicidal. They are not
right.
trying to die. They are trying to live and own how their quality of life is, to and including how it ends.
And not only that, I think it touches not just the fact for that single individual, but they are also so magnanimous in a sense because they don't want to see their loved ones having
right.
to care for them at a point when there is no alternative. I mean, you know, you put them in a hospital and the medical bills just keep piling up. I mean, doesn't make any sense to me at all.
And the story she told, which tie into this and exactly underscore your point, is that, you know, it's a lot of times the end of these things is not poetic. It isn't wonderful. It isn't, you know, easing off. It is painful and horrible. And, you know, the process is not, you know, for lack of a better term, well thought out by the universe. I mean,
how
life ends sometimes. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, to your point where we should have the technology and wherewithal to deal with it. Even if it means an end that is peaceful and we have the ways to make that happen, you know, we should.
I agree. I mean, as difficult as it is, I agree. But I think there's one key factor that we're not focusing on, the world, I'm talking the whole world in general, and that's preventative measures. The
right.
Hippocratic Oath states they prefer prevention to a cure. And we never talk about preventative measures. For instance, I found out after I was diagnosed that a low level of vitamin D as in David is a possible link to breast, colon, and prostate cancer, I believe it
wow.
is.
Wow.
Yeah. And my doctor, who we'll get into this later, but he gave me an article that talked about that, but he never said, let's check your vitamin D level, which can be done. You can go to your doctor and with your annual blood work, ask them to check off the box, let's check my vitamin D level. Doesn't cost you anything extra. And we would have seen right away I was vastly low in
wow.
vitamin D.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty terrifying.
Now, and does vitamin D, is that something where if you just eat a lot that has vitamin D that you retain it? Or is that like other things where your body is naturally depleting it?
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. They did have me take this, I don't know if you call it emulsion or it's a liquid form of vitamin D3, and that's what got my level back up.
Okay.
So, and I live in Arizona, a sunny state. We also know that you get vitamin D from being out in the sun, but I shy away from being in the sun. So, because
right.
I had melanoma, I was diagnosed with melanoma, believe it or not, the year my mom passed away. And I had two removed, and I'm perfectly fine. But wow. And I am the youngest of 11 children, and there's no cancer in my family. I just think all my older siblings sucked out all the nutrients from my mom.
There's a downside to being the hand-me-down kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like wait,
exactly.
What is this?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about some of the stories, because I remember one in particular in the book where you and your husband are sitting in front of this doctor, and she is going on and on and on about the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I mean, it was almost, I could almost see this, if this was a movie, this would almost be a comedic scene in a very sad kind of way, because
yeah.
I think your eyes were going back and forth with each other going, what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. She was considered a nurse navigator, but I renamed her the nightmare navigator. So what happened was I had mentioned to my oncologist, you know, at my first meeting, you know, I'm a bit concerned. I don't know if I have all the doctors, specialists that I require, and do I have everything in place? I mean, I'm a neophyte when it comes to this. I had, even though my mother went through it, I didn't understand anything about breast cancer, which is really sad for me to say this. I'm embarrassed by it, but my mom was born in 1922. She was raised during the Depression, and that age group just are tight-lipped. They never complain about pain. I mean, my mother was just stunning. So with that being said, I was ignorant when it comes to breast cancer. So I was trying to ascertain from this, from my oncologist, and he said, well, I know just the person you can talk to. So he brings in his nurse navigator, who is supposed to guide you and kind of help you, and, well, that's what I would think anyhow.
Right,
and
right.
That's how it was pitched to me, but instead she comes into the room, and she starts off by telling me she's going through breast cancer for the second time. And then she proceeds to tell me all about the drug tamoxifen and what she's been through. And now she's getting ready to do a double mastectomy, and told me all the different types of operations that you could choose from for a double. And I mean, this woman was going into vivid detail about everything for 1 hour. And my husband and I were just sitting there paralyzed. We were sitting there thinking in our minds, okay, is she trying to tell us something that the doctor couldn't? Or, you know, what is going on here? And finally, when you're so shell-shocked, I mean, when you're in a doctor's office and you don't know about a disease that you have and you're trying to understand it, you're taught, I've been taught always to sit and listen to what the doctor has to say.
Right.
But that wasn't the case. I mean, she just kept going on and on. And finally, I was able to find my voice, and I said to her, because I hadn't had the BRCA gene test results come back yet, and I had that done. And thankfully, it came back negative. But I said to her at the time, but we don't even know if I'm going to require a double mastectomy. And she goes, well, yeah, you're right. I just wanted to prepare you.
Yeah.
I was like, but she was personalizing it. It was like, oh, my gosh. So that that kind of turned me away from speaking to people. And then preceding her, I had a patient advocate actually before I met with any doctor other than my radiologist, and she predicted what my protocol was going to be. Meaning, I posed the same question to this woman: do I have all the doctors in the right place? Is there anything I've missed? And she says to me, "Well, you're going to have surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation." And I was just like, I felt like somebody had just punched me in the stomach, and I couldn't even talk. I got off the phone with her, and then later when I met her, I said to her, wait a minute, what am I trying? I confronted her and said, you know, I really don't appreciate you saying that. I'm at a loss of words here. I'm sorry, Robert. Predicting my outcome of my cancer.
Don't worry, we just keep talking till we find them.
Predicting the outcome. And she, you know, she was kind of shocked. Well, you know, at first she said she didn't, and then I explained to her what she said, and she said, well, I'm sorry, I've been doing this for many years, and if it goes into your lymph node, you're going to require chemotherapy. I'm sorry I'm the person to tell you this, but that's just how it is. And I was just stupefied.
So the process was really that you go through these things, and then the next step would come in should you need it. But she was just sending open door one, then two and three, and there you go.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm relating to your experience on so many levels because I have seen your parents. My dad is 92, and my mom is 90, and
I am so impressed. What great genes!
Well, goes back to that. You know, I wish it was as happy as it sounds. My dad has dementia. My mom has Alzheimer's, and if their minds were where their bodies are, it'd be great. As it turns out, it is incredibly frustrating. But we've gone through health things that's very similar to what you're talking about, where, although in this case, it wasn't a doctor who sort of pushed it through, like, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening, like, you know, it's all done deal. The doctor, my mother has had a couple of health scares. I mean, actually an amazing amount. She's like a cat with nine lives, quite frankly. But, you know, The doctor pulled me out and said, okay, this is what's going on. The last one, an aneurysm by her heart and in her her aorta, saying, okay, well, here's what's going on. I don't really know what to do. It's all bad. You could do this, and that's a disaster, and you do that, and this is a disaster, and, you know, this is a disaster. What do you want to do? And I'm like, I'm not the doctor. What do you mean?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's just, it was, it was really, really hard, and the questions that I had were not answered, you know, because I wanted to know, okay, if we do this, what will happen? Well, we're not really sure. It's like, well, what?
Yeah.
you know, and as it turns out, you know, nine lives, you know, Nancy there, she, you know, this was last Christmas, and she's just been humming along perfectly fine. So it's, you know, in terms of that.
Gosh. But,
so talk to me a little bit more, April, about the, you know, some of the other events that happen with healthcare that you would like to see changed.
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to add that I did write a tango in my book. And because I'm a musician, every single chapter is named after a song, not songs that I've written, although a few of mine are in there, but the first chapter, In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins. I have Rumor Has It by Adele, Keep It Loose, Keep It Tight by, my brain tonight is doing well, isn't it? Amos Lee, who I absolutely love that guy. And so it's really unique how I put the book together. And as for things that I would like to see change in our healthcare system, well, I already talked about prevention. I think we need to make more strides on that in conjunction with a cure, because there's too many people that have cancer right now. We still need to proceed in that direction, but we need to talk preventative measures here. And, we can't necessarily just point at food being the culprit or whatnot, because cancer has no face. You can
right.
be, you know, fat, thin, purple, green, orange, it doesn't matter. It hits everyone. It does have one face, fear, but that's it. So, you know, we need to look at prevention, take a hard look at it and figure out what's going on here. As far as personalized care, one of the things that I recommend for people to take action now for their health is to align themselves with a great internist. I think that's where I faltered, because I did not have a great relationship with my internist. I only saw him when I had the flu or for the occasional, my annual exams, health wellness checkups, but that was really it. And he didn't care for me as a patient, because I'm the type that does not like to take prescription medication. And whenever I was sick, I tore my meniscus. He told me it was arthritis at 35 that miraculously happened overnight, and wanted to give me pain pills and all this stuff. And I was like, no. And I figured out on my own that it was a torn meniscus and had the surgery done. My leg's fine now. So we really need to focus on finding internists that are looking out for our best interests, but
right.
not only looking out for our best interests, but listen to us and know our medical history. That is so important. With all the drugs they throw at you, you know, you never know what the side effects are. Speaking of, tamoxifen, every doctor of mine was wanting me to go on this cancer-fighting drug, which I think is amazing for some women. I know that it has kept women alive that are today, fighting or through cancer, but preventing it from reoccurring. But for me, I had hideous side effects after a year of being on it. I mean, really bad. I do not do well on prescription medications. But I had to do research on the drug, and I saw that it could cause blood clots, which within my family and on the family questionnaire I gave to my doctors, it stated that I have siblings and my mom had deep vein thrombosis, which means we had a tendency to develop blood clots. I had to bring this up to the oncologist,
right.
not him.
Right.
So you have to be your own advocate, but it would be nice if you had a doctor that knew all of these things. So when you're going over the side effects of a drug, you can look it over with an expert. And I think that's where an internist should play a bigger role. I think we should get away from how many patients can you see and make it more about the patients themselves.
Right. Yeah, you covered three things that you have in your book of recommendation: preventative health care, personalized health care, and compassionate health care.
That one's a huge one.
Yeah.
I think. That, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Compassion is really non-existent in healthcare, and it starts with the administrative staff. I find it intriguing that before you can work in a restaurant, you're required to go get certified to handle food. However, any Joe Schmo can come off the street and be hired by a doctor to run their office, answer their phones. Who are you dealing with on a daily basis? These admin people. And a lot of them are bullies. I don't know if they're just angry with their lives or what it is, but I'm a really nice person. Every morning when I got up, I put a smile on my face and was determined to get through this and back to the life I love. And it was very difficult dealing with some of these individuals. Now, on the flip side, I met some amazing people too, but it's the difficult ones that make it so arduous and impede your sense of healing too. So
Right. Yeah. Well, it's my observation in the different healthcare I've witnessed. And again, to your point, it's not everybody, but it's some people. I am very aware on some of the people that, I've worked with, everything about their day. It's like that when they ask me what I want and, you know, I'm making a request, and when I see how little it is registering on them, I see all the paperwork, all the, you know, things that they've had to deal with, and their headaches of the day sort of just are being worn right there on their sleeves. Mm-hmm. And when somebody is suffering and sick, I think it should be the opposite, where they're being there to make that other person's experience of their walk into the hospital, you know, relieved.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And no one's trained in compassion. I interviewed several doctors and nurses, and I asked them, are you all required to take classes? And I did research online, and they all say, no, there's no such thing as compassion 101 when you go to medical school. I said, well, how are you taught that? And they said, by watching others. I was like, you can't teach compassion that way. And what if you get Nurse Ratchet at night that doesn't like,
right.
I heard of this nurse that doesn't like to be worked day shift because she doesn't like people. And if she works the night shift, all the patients are asleep, so she doesn't have to deal with them.
Right.
Wow.
And I can tell you this, little things, like when I would go to the hospital when one of my folks was in the hospital for an ailment, and I would ask for the nurse to find out what was going on, because it was very hard to get any kind of reports on their status. And because my folks are Alzheimer's and dementia, you know, they're not retaining anything. So if it was said to them at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, I get none of that when I come, you know, later in the morning. And when I make the request of the nurse to come in, I know I'm going to sit there for an hour, hour and a half before they finally come in.
Right.
And
isn't that sad?
Yeah. It's just, you know, it definitely sends a message about the priority of that. So I want to kind of segue to what you had alluded to before about the songs and the structure of the book. Plus, you, besides naming the disease Jorge, you have quite a few other colorful naming conventions of the breast surgeon is medicine woman, the radiation oncologist was radiation man, the oncologist number two was the king, oncologist number three was Dr. Cool. It makes the book very much of a, almost like a Alice in Wonderland kind of feel to it. You know,
I guess it does.
Was that, I mean, I guess I'm very cinematic, but I'm picturing the movie. Yeah.
Oh, who'd want to watch a movie about this?
Hey, you know what? Now it could be quite an engaging movie, I think.
Yeah, I can tell you the protagonist lives, so that's a good thing, right?
There you go. So happy ending. So.
Yes. Oh, shoot. Yeah, I renamed everyone because in the beginning, I started getting all this literature on cancer. Literally, I was getting books called C101, and I thought, it was so overwhelming and depressing, and not to mention all the literature had old white women on it, old women with white hair on it. That came out totally wrong, didn't it? and it was depressing. I was only 46. I was like, this can't be my life. And so, I had all these little binders and stuff. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to make my own binder, which is exactly what I did. And all the literature that came from the doctors, I made their own tab, and I just started naming the doctors. And a lot of it came from their personalities when I'd meet them. Some I named them beforehand, like my first oncologist, I named him the mad scientist. And believe it or not, when he walked in the room, that's exactly what he looked like. It almost freaked me out a bit. And right now, I don't even remember my doctor's names. It's really pathetic because I guess I got so ensconced, is that the right word,
right,
in this
right.
book. That I look at people sometimes, I'm thinking, medicine woman, that's not her name. What is her name? I have to reach really deep to remember my doctor's actual name. So, yeah. But no, and I named the one cancerous lymph node that I had, the lymphalong kid. So, I had fun with it. You have to make fun of life,
that,
right?
That, I mean, that's sort of the element of why I think this would be a great cinematic work, even though it's on a serious subject and even though it's, you know, educational. But it does, you do apply this fanciful feel through the whole thing with the music and the dance and the names and, you know, as you're dealing with these absurdities that make it, you give it a flow. I mean, did you feel that as you were experiencing it?
Absolutely. I actually wrote a tango in my book, and that chapter title I took from the Moulin Rouge movie, where the song De Roxanne, which they renamed El Tango De Roxanne. When that, what happened to me in that chapter, when it occurred, I was not there physically in the room. I was actually on a dance floor watching this woman sitting on a broken chair on an old broken wooden floor, and then all of a sudden these demon men come in and start tossing her around like a rag doll, and that's what I was seeing, and all the voices that were talking were echoing in the room. And there was one other element to it, which I can't say because then I'd name the person, and I don't want to do that. I purposely renamed everyone in my book, so you can't, you won't know who they are. That's why I did that. And so within that chapter, I switched between reality and being in that alternate world.
Right.
Yeah. And it did help, I think, that I was also, before this hit, in the middle of writing an album with a classical flamenco guitarist from San Miguel de Allende, and who toured with Doc Severinsen for many years. His name is Gil Gutierrez. So I was in that Latin feel too.
Right. Well, there are no accidents. I mean, it's like you're set up for your inspiration.
Yeah. And actually the cover of the book, it was going to be similar to what I had planned for my album cover for the Temptation album we're working on, but it ended up being the book. So, wow.
Well, I actually love that because the picture on the book is, I think you in a red dress, right?
It is.
And yeah, but you're dancing with kind of a surreal character, and it's the feeling
and
from
that's
the
Jorge image. Actually.
Yeah. No, that's what I figured. Yeah, because he's kind of splitting apart, like, you know.
Yes.
You know, he's being eradicated. But it's you have music, you have that tango feel about it, but you don't look happy.
And you know, I got so much pushback on this cover because everyone's like, "Oh, you need to go look at the books that are on Amazon and the other online stores or whatever, and look at the book covers that women have," which a lot of them were purple butterflies, a lot of pink. People's faces on it. I'm like, this is not representative nor indicative of what cancer is. Cancer is a mean, nasty, horrible thing. And everyone said, "I hate the look on your face. You look so scared." Cancer is scary. What are we talking about? Why are we trying to pink coat what cancer is, what breast cancer is? It's, you know, that's not what it is. That's not what it's about. So that's how I came up with that.
I love it. So
thank you.
Yeah, to all your naysayers. I love the image on the front. It is the look is a fearful, strong, fighting. You know, it's like there's a fancifulness about it. You know, that kind of rhythmic, you know, melody, if you will. But it captures kind of the I mean this in a weird sort of musical way, but almost like the violence of a tango. You know, tangos are kind of like the most violent kind of dancing. It's like you feel like you're watching a musical fight when you see somebody who's really in that tango. And
And the genesis of a tango is it's a woman. It started out as just women who danced it only by themselves. Did you know that?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
No
so
idea.
The fact that I used all these symbolisms, and there's more on the cover than that, just that, and I can tell you a little bit too about that. But yeah, it was. So, I didn't realize, and that's how it was on my. Shapeshifter album, we go back to the sense of how do you come up with these ideas. It's truly somebody's talking to me. I'm channeling someone or whatever, because I painted my face on my Shapeshifter album, and I didn't know all the nuances within our tribe completely, and it ends up that the zigzag that I did down the side of my face is representative of a snake in Native American culture. Okay, I get that, but I painted mine backwards, which represents Comanches, and I did not know that. And
wow.
I called on my uncle, who was a fantastic Comanche artist, Leonard Riddles. He took on my great 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 grandfather's name, Duamua Black Moon. That's what he painted under. But I asked him specifically. He had passed away to help me paint my face that day, and wow, is that crazy?
No, I think it's wonderful. I mean, it's part of the spirit of your book itself, is that you have these challenges, you have this system. It isn't fun. It isn't fanciful. I mean, that's part of, I think, the real power of the book, is that while the experience is anything but fanciful, you address it from your soul with music and tango and dance, and you know that's where the strength comes from. And I would love to see your book come out with an album that has the songs of every chapter, because as it was going through, it's like, you know, it's like I wanted to hear the song before I read the chapter. You know, so
I know,
like,
but I didn't want to have to worry about the royalties, and I don't know how works. So I figured everyone can go to iTunes and purchase the different songs and create their own album. But
there you go.
Yeah, but I've specifically put down who sang it or who the instrumentalists were in some cases, or both, just so you knew which rendition I was referring to. What song, because different artists sing it so vastly different,
right.
It meant different things to me. Yeah.
Now, one of the songs is your own, Black and White. What?
Yes.
What is the story behind your own song? Actually, I take that back. You have a couple of your own songs listed. Black and White and Face the World.
Yeah. Boy, that's a. Go ahead.
Where did those songs come from, and how did they make your cut into the book?
Okay, so I'm going to give a hint, but only one life, only one life difficulty at a time. But so when I was younger, I went through some crazy, crazy stuff, and how it comes out of me sometimes is in music. And let's see, Black and White, that is about losing your name and trying to find it again, trying to find who you are. And Black and White was the family form that I was required to fill out and get all of the horrible, hideous information from my family members about their illnesses and whatnot. And I talked to over 50 people to get all the information, because my family's so huge, and I wasn't anticipating that. So that's basically what that is about, is dealing with family and personalities and things. That's how that song came about. But then I used it in that form, in that sense, in the book. So, yeah. Wow.
And Face the World, what was that one?
Face the World is just being able to get up every morning, no matter what life is throwing at you that day, or maybe it's cancer, maybe it's, you know, discrimination, whatever it is, you look yourself in the mirror, you put a smile on your face, and you just say, you're going to make it. Doesn't matter who people are, what they're trying to tell you to do, it's you ultimately in the end. And that's, I think, one of my strengths that I never realized I had was to always look to the future and know there was going to be a great ending. I really, really believe from my heart, our lives are like pendulums. If you look at them, at least it is for me, I can have one hideously horrible thing happen to me, and then that pendulum swings back, and one of the most amazing things will happen in my life. I consider myself very fortunate.
This is going to relate to that because there used to be a thing, and it didn't catch on, and it was kind of a weird background of called biorhythms, and this is years and years ago, that was trying to track kind of the events of your life around sort of a rhythmic thing. And mm-hmm. I really kind of related to it though, because I found that, you know, life has a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense. And a lot of it just kind of rhythms itself out of your life without,
right.
You know, and it's sort of like whatever is going on right now won't stay, you know, it
right.
will change. So, okay. I have a little shock for you.
Okay.
We're down to our final 4 minutes.
Wow, this went by so fast, Rob.
Right.
You're so enjoyable
Don't with. You wish that medical science was as painless as my radio show?
Oh, gosh. Don't say that because I would have gone back in for more treatments. No, that's horrible.
Okay, that's
I am teasing.
That's the compliment I've ever received, but that's
great. I know. Isn't that a strange one?
One quick thing I want to throw in is you are going to be joining me, and I don't have the date in front of me, which is my bad, but on my Out in Santa Cruz show, which can be heard on outinsantacruz.com, Saturday nights at 7 p.m., and I do want to give a quick plug. This week, we are going to be talking about remembering Matthew Shepard. We are at the anniversary of his death, and we are going to talk about National Coming Out Day. And I've got two incredibly special guests, Preston Grant, the author of Gay Explained, who actually was living with the man who launched National Coming Out Day, mm-hmm. and Brody Levesque, who is a journalist who was in Laramie, covered the events of Matthew's death, got to know the family, and so he's going to give us firsthand account of what happened there. So, April, with that,
wow.
I'm going to give you the last 2 minutes of what more do you want people to know about Tango with Cancer, and where can they get the book?
Sure. You can purchase the book anywhere. You go to my website. I have a couple of places that you can order online. It's on iBooks right now, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. If you go to a bookstore, just ask them if they have my book. If they don't, ask them to order it, please. Let's see. You can go to my website, aprilallen.com. That's aprilallen.com or atangowithcancer.com. And our show, I'm going to be on your show next time on November 19th.
There we go.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And
I'm glad one of us had our act together tonight. Very good.
There you go. Happened to be on my phone. That was a good thing. I'm really hoping that people, what they learn from this book is what I experienced. I don't want them to fall in those same footsteps. I'm hoping people can learn from it and maybe dance the tango better than I did, because I did a lousy job.
I'm going to disagree on that one. I think you did a pretty darn good job. The tango was not easy, and you stepped gracefully through it. And I also want to point out on aprilallen.com is your music, which people absolutely need to go check out. And,
so sweet. And thank you for letting me talk about something else than cancer. What a nice segue.
no problem. Cause that really is it. It's cancer isn't life. Life has cancer in it sometimes.
Right.
So, thank you. And I'm so glad we have another show to do, because
me
then
too.
I don't really have to say goodbye here. We're
I love
going
it.
To just say till next time.
Till next time. And I look forward to it. Thank you so
Me
much,
too.
Rob. Gracious
Me too.
Host.
Oh, thank you. We're going to have more fun. So you guys have been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Come back next week. We will have more for you. Listen to Garrett Miller on Rated G Radio, which he is also putting his hicks into April to get her music on. So watch for announcements on that. And don't forget Blonde Jesus. He has a new video out, and his album is on GarrettMiller.com. You want to take advantage of that as well. Good night.
Good night.